Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Right Dishonourable. My name's Jazza.
My name's Jimmy.
And we talk weekly about topics and current events and those
topics.
Kinds of things.
Topics.
Topics, indeed. It's really been a bloody depressing week, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's putting it quite mildly.
I've been in a terrible, terrible... But let's just... Forget that, like, world-changing things are happening.
Let's talk about Jazza's mood.
Yeah, so I've just been in a terrible, terrible mood with everybody this week.
Is that related to events, or is that
related,
you being a knob?
Related to... Well, both. but the inner knob comes out whenever I'm under stress.
Questionable phrasing, I think.
Excellent. Well, at least we have a slight amount of comic relief. This week there was little that we could talk about other than the three big stories that are kind of
in the ether.
In the ether and very much invading everybody's thoughts and minds at the moment. We are going to talk about the Orlando shootings that happened last week in a gay bar in Orlando on a Latin night where 49 people were killed and about 50 people were injured at the hands of a man called Omar...
Mateen.
Thank you.
There you go.
For covering over my ignorance there. Who initially, allegedly, I'm not sure if this is allegedly, but he initially pledged allegiance to ISIS before he shot all of these LGBT people.
So, as I understand it, during the shooting he phoned 911 and during the course of that
called
phone
911
call,
on himself, which is an
odd...
But
they often do that, these sort of people. So.
Yeah, well, great.
There you go.
And so we're going to be talking about the implication of that, what it means for the LGBT community, and also Islam in the US, because everybody's bae, Trump, has been tirading off in his usual pro-gun anti-Islam spiel, which has been incredibly constructive for everybody involved, I
Indeed.
Must say. Secondly, we, off the back of one horrific gun-based violence event, we in the UK had our own version of that, and these are particularly rare. She's the first MP, Jo Cox, the Labour MP, was shot dead in her constituency.
She's the first MP to die since 1990.
Yeah.
Be killed since, obviously not to die.
Yeah.
That would be crazy. To be killed since 1990, and that was, I can't remember the name of the guy, but I believe that was IRA related.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And because of legal reasons, we have to be careful about what we say about the perpetrator of the attack, because courts are a thing, and Jimmy's given me a very
stern talking to.
But so, basically, what we want to do is to talk about basically the nation's and the media's reaction to Jo Cox's death. The fact that the EU referendum campaign was on pause for a few days. Some media outlets have been accused of politicising her death for their own gains. And specifically about the way that LBC and their presenters, the London broadcaster, the way that they've been talking about it. And then finally, what are we going to talk about, Jimmy?
Well, you might have heard, but there's a small referendum going on in Britain.
It's pretty unimportant.
It's pretty trivial, and it's happening this Thursday. You might have heard us discuss it before. It's the EU referendum, whether Britain is going to remain part of...
you may have heard us talk about it before, but we genuinely have tried to reduce the amount that we talk about the EU as much as possible, and we've still talked about it like 6 or 7 times since the beginning of the year.
Probably more than that,
it ends next week.
Well, we've got the fallout as well, potentially.
Yeah,
so
great, good.
That's fun. That might keep us tidied over for the next couple of weeks.
I think I'm just going to be far too depressed. Basically, this is also one of the main reasons that I've been really down for the past week, is because I just think that Brexit are going to win.
If Brexit happens, it's possible Jazza may be too depressed to podcast ever again. So this is going to be a time capsule.
Genuinely. I've been shopping around for other nationalities. Spain is obviously dear to my heart, but I think I like Danish at the moment.
Interesting.
They're really happy and got great dogs.
Well, there you go. If you vote to leave the EU, Jazza will move to Denmark. should we play music and get going?
Help us.
So last Saturday, Omar Mateen entered the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, and shot dead 50 people, injuring 50 more. This has been actually the worst terrorist attack in American history, obviously, since 9/11, and it's the worst gun atrocity in modern American history, certainly.
Also the worst hate crime against, in terms of deaths against LGBT people, so, as well, since the Holocaust.
So a significant event all round. Mm-hmm. Obviously, what's happened this week in Britain has somewhat diverted attention away from that, but... Jazza, obviously, as a member of the LGBT community, you are...
Got a card and everything.
Got, you know, paid up member of the LGBT community. This is, I guess, like, psychologically, this probably affected you a lot more than it did me. Like, that seems to have been the response from some gay people in the media talking about this. Is that a fair comment? You're looking a little bit sceptical.
Oh, no. Like, you're 100% correct. It was... really fucking odd, and I obviously made a video about this, where I was genuinely just, I was distraught at work, and I needed to do something, and when Jazza feels like he needs to do something, he talks to cameras, because then it feels like I'm such a wanker, and I hate myself, but it was, one of the things that really brought it home to me was when Anderson Cooper, there was a video where where the names of those who lost their lives were announced. And there's always, like, as tradition, when you have those kinds of moments on TV, like a little spiel from, like, their family and friends and what they're like. Mm. And when they were saying, like, these people's names and, like... he was the life and soul of the party and loved singing Adele as loud as he could in the office and those kinds of things. All I could hear was descriptions of people that I know and love and descriptions of, like, other LGBT people. And I, like, burst into tears at my desk and needed to, like, take a moment in, like, the toilets and just kind of rock myself backwards and forwards. It's really close to home.
Well, there's an interesting piece by Andrew Sullivan, who's a gay journalist who lives in America originally from England, and he wrote in the Sunday Times today that a gay club for an LGBT person has a place in their lives that where they can express themselves and be open, that doesn't really apply to being a straight person going into a nightclub. The relationship is far deeper.
It's very different. Gay clubs are the only safe spaces for us.
Yeah.
And there's a reason that they still exist. And you know about this with me and my boyfriend, when we walk down the street in the UK, in London, in a metropolitan city, we still get abuse, like screamed at us. We can go to a gay club or a gay bar or Soho, and we can just be another couple in the crowd.
Yeah.
And that's why these places are still important, and that's why these places are still really powerful and symbolic for us, because it's the only place that really you can let loose and you don't have to look over your shoulder to make sure that there isn't somebody who might make a fuss if you were to, like, give your boyfriend a kiss.
Sure, yeah.
And that's also why it's such an intimate kind of attack on our, like, the word safe spaces is probably used too much, but it really is what they are. They're places that we are able to be ourselves, and we're able to create families where we lost ours because of a homophobic parents or homophobic family members. These are places where we create our new world and our new identities, and to have that come under attack is really quite horrible. And so it was quite frustrating, not just in the UK, but across the world in terms of media coverage. Frustrating to see the LGBT aspect of this glossed over.
I was going to say, when the news initially came out and you found out it was an attack on a gay nightclub, did you immediately know did you immediately think that's definitely a factor in all of this? Like, this is a deliberate targeting of a gay nightclub as opposed to anywhere else?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because, like, why would you just go in and shoot up a gay nightclub? why wouldn't you go to another bigger nightclub that has a straight clientele, that where there's more people, where it's more well known? If you choose to specifically attack a gay nightclub, they are, if you want to incite terror into absolutely everybody, and this was why I kind of had a, I have a problem with calling this terrorism, because I think terrorism is meant to install terror into like a specific into absolutely everybody's hearts. When the IRA,
do you think that's true?
Yes,
I mean, it's possible to have terrorism targeted towards a specific minority in a wider society, though, isn't it?
Very true. But so, for example, when the IRA used to bomb like shopping centres and stuff, they didn't care who was affected by that. They just wanted people to be fearful. When 9/11 happened and people drove planes, when people flew planes into those buildings, they didn't care who was there. They just wanted people terrified.
Attacks, but on specifically Britain in the IRA case, and then America in the Al Qaeda case.
But then, so that's why the reason that somebody chose to attack this club is because it was where minorities hung out. Minorities that he thought were disgusting.
But you wouldn't call this terrorism.
And so I would call it a hate crime rather than terrorism.
Is it necessary for the two to be mutually exclusive?
No, but I think that hate crime is probably a more accurate description of it. And I do think, because we now know some extra stuff about the shooter, we know that he was on Grindr. He frequented this nightclub often, made approaches to other clientele regularly, was clearly a closeted gay man, and had an issue with that and had anger issues. And
the reason for his closetedness was because of his Muslim father and the fact that he was a Muslim as well, right?
Perhaps. But it was said that he wasn't a particularly devout Muslim, which I think is also important. And I think that if this were a white supremacist who had gone into this club and done the shooting, I think it would have been called a hate crime rather than terrorism. And I think it was only called terrorism because of the fact that he shouted ISIS, despite the fact that there isn't a huge amount of... ISIS is that all of their terror is outsourced, right?
Sure, but, yeah. But, I mean, he does have an allegiance to ISIS, doesn't he?
He had history with other people who had gone to the Middle East, yes.
And the FBI, in its investigation of the crime at the nightclub, have said they're investigating potential terrorist links surrounding him. I don't think you can sort of argue a lot of the ISIS-related crimes outside of the Middle East, the links with the agents on the ground, as it were, and ISIS are sometimes not necessarily that strong. But I still think there's an Islamic element to this attack, in the shooter's background, and in his motivation for what happened. That appears to be quite a strong theme, I would say.
I think that first of all, he was a gay man with internalised homophobia, or somebody with same-sex attraction with internalised homophobia, and that's why he carried out this attack. And he used teachings from ISIS and like extremism with ISIS to justify the anger and the feelings that he had to go and kill those people.
So why do you think he had those feelings in the first place?
Because it's very possible to grow up in the US and be homophobic and to have a repressed sexuality.
I mean, but the obvious answer is that his dad was a Muslim and that he grew up in a Muslim family.
I don't think we have any evidence of that yet.
Well, there was a lot of speculation in what you just said. You know,
I think that there's less speculation in what I'm saying than what you're saying.
I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, it's obvious that, you know, Islam has a problem with homosexuality. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before on the podcast. Mm-hmm. It seems an obvious link that if somebody has, as you put it, internalised homophobia, is a closeted gay man, and they come from a Muslim family, it's obvious that those two things play with one another. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not speculation. That's basic logic.
Yeah, but then you also get the same with people who justify internalised homophobia and trying to scare themselves straight in Christianity. Like, Christianity has more of a history of that than Islam does, I would argue.
I'm not sure that's true, but in this specific case, it's sort of irrelevant because, you know... But, I mean, this conversation we're having is a smaller version of the politicisation of what happened in Orlando in the American media. What do you make of, like, what... Of how, say, the anti-gun lobby tried to make it about guns and then the anti-Islam lobby tried to make it about Islam. What do you make of what happened?
I'm a bit terrified about the fact that there's an anti-Islam lobby. I think that's just called Fox News.
Well, yeah.
But I believe that this is very clearly a problem with gun crime. And accessibility of guns more than anything. Yeah. More than anything. Because he would have not been able to get his hands on an AK... not an AK-47, but like an assault rifle.
Sure.
If America had any kind of sensible kind of gun laws. And that's something that's really quite confusing. And I think gets kind of skimmed over in other countries' reporting of these kinds of events because we're like, well, what is America doing? Anyway, the other things. You know, like, it just seems really obvious that somebody who had anger issues, who had a wife who left him because he was violent against her, who was on a no-fly list or was on a watch list.
He was on a watch list for 8 or 9 months, but they took him off because they didn't find his... the terrorist links that he boasted about to his colleagues.
Someone with that kind of a profile is still able to go into a gun shop and buy an assault rifle that can be folded up so small you can fit it in a trench coat pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's loco, and that is the thing that could have prevented this from happening.
Yeah, I mean, you would still get, you know, gun violence even if America had tighter gun laws, though. Mm-hmm. So.
No, of course, but I think that this is... the problem is that people can get their hands on weapons of war. Like, your ability to go shooting or to protect your house or to, practice shooting on a gun range is not affected if you can't have a bloody assault rifle. Assault rifles are specifically used so that you can kill as many people as possible on a battlefield. Why does a citizen have any requirement for that? At all.
Well, I suppose at this stage you could argue that America has so many guns that the logic of, like...
More guns than people, right?
Yeah, it's like 1.16 guns to every person, 320 million guns or something like that, to 300 million people. Round about that.
Yeah.
At this point, the logic of actually dealing with a problem like that is obviously very different from dealing with a country that, say, has no gun laws but doesn't have an excess of guns, if you see what I mean, or has lax gun laws. One thing I was actually going to ask you about is that there was, and this does come back to the Islam thing because we talked about the guns, but Douglas Murray, the British journalist, are you familiar with him?
No, I'm not.
He writes for The Spectator, but he wrote this article for... I think it was the National Review, which is a similar magazine in the States, about the sort of gay community's relationship with Islam and how... I mean, I think people who listen to this podcast will actually see that there's a certain reluctance on your part to acknowledge or, like, talk about problems with Islam and homophobia, say. Do you see that as a valid reaction to what's happened here? Do you think that the gay community should acknowledge it more?
The way that I've started to describe it is Islam has a problem. Islam isn't the problem. It's very, very possible to be a non-homophobic, non-violent Muslim. The majority of Muslims are incredibly capable of doing that.
I'm not sure it's true the majority of Muslims are not homophobic.
No, but there's... The reason that I have issues with those kinds of statements about Islam is because, like, only decades ago, Christianity was used as a beat to stick the LGBT community with.
Mm-hmm.
And all I see with Islam is them being a few decades behind. It was a very short time ago that exactly the same kind of religious arguments were used to give people like, to take away rights of people like me, and to say that we deserve to go in jail.
But it doesn't necessarily follow that Islam is on the same course of reform as Christianity is. I mean, apart from anything else, the sort of countries that Christianity was strong in 40 years ago, and still, you know, is relatively strong in, are quite different countries politically in terms of their governance models than Muslim countries.
Do you think?
Yeah, massively so.
What about places like Indonesia?
Indonesia is an interesting example.
Places like Jordan, Turkey.
Turkey has a very like unique.
They've got a dodgy president.
They have a unique relationship with Islam as well, mm-hmm. because it's a secularized country that's now regressing. But that actually kind of speaks to my point, is that I don't think you can necessarily assume that Islam is going to go the same way that Christianity has gone. That doesn't take account of all the other varying factors in Christianity's relationship with modernity versus Islam's relationship with modernity.
Christianity is used as a way of keeping people like controlled and downtrodden in Africa.
Yeah.
Like, in the same way that Islam is.
Yes, no, I agree.
And
I think
somebody's willingness to accept homosexuality or to agree that people who happen to be born LGBT should have the same rights as anybody else, I think that says more about the type of country that you grow up in rather than the religion that you are raised with.
That's almost the point I just said, is that...
How?
In the sense that I said Christianity reformed because Christianity's home was in Europe and in the United States.
No, but a lot of Christianity hasn't reformed. A lot of Christianity still allows for FGM. That, like, female genital mutilation is often seen as an Islam problem. It's not as an African problem, because Christian countries in
obviously, Islam's different in different regions, but in the Islam of North Africa and the Middle East, they have governance models that actually mirror Africa's governance models in a lot of ways. And therefore, the fact that you've said, like, Christianity in Africa has not reformed in the way that Christianity in Europe has reformed, that is kind of the point I was trying to make.
But I mean, even Indonesia, which
is relatively democratic and is relatively modern from a governance point of view, is not great on homosexual rights. So even a country that actually is mimicking some of the European governance structures still has the same problems.
Yeah, but Jimmy, the thing is, May I be anecdotal with you?
Yeah, go ahead.
So me and a few friends of mine have a WhatsApp group. And we were talking about the football. And I said that at the moment I'm not going to be supporting England in the Euros because of the fact that England fans have had been videoed and have had a really, really bad behaviour in France during the European Championships. One of my other friends, he said, "Oh, I can't believe that you're allowing for a minority to represent like the way that the majority is, blah 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 blah." And then our Muslim friend who was in the chat said, "Welcome to the life of being a Muslim." And I think
it's not a minority for some of these problems in Islam. They're not a minority at all.
No, but when you say Islam is the problem, then it stops there from allowing for there to be a bridge between where we want Islam to be and where the majority of the Muslim world is. My friend, who is born and raised in this country and is not a hugely practicing Muslim, is that bridge between those two worlds. And as soon as you say, "Oh no, Islam is the problem," it prevents there to be allowed that dialogue.
The thing is, though, you've just said, you've kind of not explicitly but implicitly admitted that Islam is the problem.
No,
you just don't want to say it's the problem.
Islam has a problem. Islam has a problem with the way that it treats women in a lot of countries and the way that it treats homosexual people in a lot of countries. But Islam itself is as homophobic as other religions across the world.
Not all of them.
Yeah, Christianity explicitly
Christianity
really,
as practiced in Africa and as practiced in certain parts of the Bible Belt in the US, but not in Catholic South America, for instance.
No, just as people who live in the centre of London and were born and raised here, or second generation British Pakistani, just as they don't have as much of a problem with me as perhaps somebody who is like someone like Omar Mateen.
Yeah, but I mean,
it depends on the person and somebody's religious background.
Poor example on your part, because British Islam does have a problem with homosexuality. I mean, half of British Muslims, according to that poll, that Channel 4 documentary was based on, think that homosexuality should be illegal.
But we also see that the majority of people, as they end up being born and raised in this country, as you get more and more generations of
we've seen the opposite of that, is that actually the first generation of immigrants are better integrated and have values that are nearer to their native counterparts than the second and third generations.
Well, I don't know about that. But I think that when you say, oh, Islam is the problem, what do you think needs to happen? That people shouldn't be allowed to be Muslim?
No.
People are going to be Muslim. And if you go into that conversation saying your religion is the problem, who are you going to win over?
Yeah, but I mean, that's a PR thing, really.
Yeah, but that's important.
It is important.
The way that you address the problem that Islam has is not by saying your religion is the issue.
Their religion is the issue.
Their religion has an issue.
No, the religion is the issue. It's baked into the religion. It's baked into the way that their religion...
In the same way that it is with other religions. In exactly the same way that it is with other religions.
Not all of them. Like, yeah, there's a false equivalence here that is really, like, terrible. Like, religions have different ideas about the way the world is, and therefore they have different effects on how, you know, they interact with the world. Their adherents interact with the world.
And...
It seems to me you're just diverting attention here. You're saying, well, yeah, okay.
I'm not diverting attention.
Islam's bad, but there's other stuff that's bad as well. And it's like, honestly say Islam is a problem? Like,
Islam is not a problem, and I will never say that, because I have friends who are Muslim who have been nothing... like, they are just my friends, and they happen to be my friends. And I will not say that something that they have grown up with, that they happen to be, in the same way that I happen to have grown
Islam
up with...
Islam isn't something you are, it's something you believe.
No, it's something that you are. You cannot...
No, you can be a Muslim, but you believe in Islam. It's a belief system. It's like politics. Like, you... I mean, yeah, so, sure, we talk about people, they say he is a conservative, but what we really mean by that is he has conservative beliefs. We don't think it's, like, set in stone. He could stop being a conservative, he could start being a liberal or a socialist or whatever, and it's the same with Islam.
But you're implying that in order to be Islamic, I suppose, is the word that I should be using if we're talking about Islam and Muslims differently, then you need to adhere to absolutely everything that's ever been taught in Islam.
I think it's suggestive that the more you moderate your view of Islam, as in the fewer of the tenets of Islam you actually believe in, your ideology fits in with Western standards of human rights and that sort of thing.
But that's exactly the same thing with what Christianity has had to go through.
It is, yeah. But as I said earlier, I don't think Islam is necessarily on the same course that Christianity is.
And I think that by saying that Islam is the problem, you're not going to be helping that course in any way, shape or form, because it increases the amount of otherness that they have to
I disagree, because it is accurately describing the problem.
Well, I think that we've laid out our stalls quite effectively.
We have, yes. That's true.
Jimmy's wrong. obviously, if you guys have any thoughts about this, then please do reach out to us on Twitter. We're now going to continue the really depressing talk to talk about the response to Joe Cox MP's death. This is going to be a mission of an episode, isn't it?
Yeah. So.
Excellent.
Abandon ship.
On Thursday of last week, we very sadly ended up having Joe Cox, a member of Parliament for the Labour Party, shot and killed in her constituency in Yorkshire. She leaves behind two kids and a husband, and over the past week we've seen like a outpouring of grief, quite obviously, from across the political spectrum, saying that she was an amazing woman, how she campaigned for refugee rights. She used to be a head of policy at Oxfam. And we obviously are not able to talk about the court case that is going on against the gentleman who
is accused.
Thank you for choosing my words for me there. is accused of killing her. You can read about him elsewhere. What we want to talk about is the fallout of kind of like the media responses to Joe Cox's death. Specifically, because I listen to LBC, the call-in radio station, quite a lot, I want to talk about LBC's reaction to it, because this is the sphere that I know. LBC is quite an interesting broadcaster to listen to because they have a wide variety of political views on the air. They have lefty liberals like James O'Brien, like hardcore conservatives like Ian Dale, and racists like Katie Hopkins.
I didn't realise racist was a political position.
So we have in the past few days there was obviously an awful lot of kind of like talk about what has kind of like caused this amount of tension to be wound up in the United Kingdom. James O'Brien, who is one of my favourite broadcasters, he's bloody brilliant, I kind of want to be him when I grow up. He talks about the tone of politics in this country being a poison of drip, drip, drip in people's ears, pushing them to be very anti-other, anti-immigration, etc., etc., and that might push them, people of unsound mind, to do particular things.
I don't know if he referenced it specifically in that monologue that you're referring to, but there was a poster unveiled by Nigel Farage of the Leave campaign.
Oh, don't worry, we'll talk about that in the Brexit.
I think it's worth referencing here, just in passing. It's a poster of a line of migrants. I think the photo was taken in Slovakia offhand. And it just says breaking point in large letters. And one notable thing about the line of people is that they're all non-white.
Mm-hmm. They're all young men. Or the majority are young men.
They look almost all as young men, as you say. And this, when this poster was released, it was branded as racist. And it is an example of what O'Brien was talking about.
Yeah.
Right?
In response to this, Ian Dale, who is obviously further right of on the political spectrum than James O'Brien,
I'd say he's a centrist Tory.
He's he's a David Cameron Tory. Shall I say that?
Yeah,
do you reckon that's about where he lands?
I'm not sure if he supports David Cameron directly, but
no.
Yeah.
He actually, without using James O'Brien's name, called him out and said that this isn't a nation's responsibility, this is one person's responsibility. One person's alleged responsibility.
Oh, dear.
And that this whole thing should not be politicised, especially around somebody who has just died. At the time that Ian Dale made those comments, the campaign for the EU referendum had been suspended and there wasn't meant to be any active campaigning because of Joe Cox's death. And then Katie Hopkins
stepped into the arena.
She did. I like her.
Yeah?
I met her and she was very charming.
Okay.
And actually quite vulnerable. You'd be surprised, our Katie. Katie Hopkins was outraged.
I believe you need to refer to her as Media Gobshite. Katie Hopkins.
Media Gobshite.
That's the accepted job title.
Katie Hopkins. She did like a bit of a rant on her show where she said it's quite disgusting the way that the Remain camp have used Joe Cox's death as political ammunition, because Joe Cox was very pro refugees. She was pro EU. She was campaigning on the Remain side. The fact that people are kind of in her obituaries saying that she was somebody who would have wanted the country to vote in, that's tugging at people's heartstrings in a quite dishonest and manipulative way.
I don't know it's any more dishonest or manipulative than most of the stuff we've seen over the course of this referendum debate, if I'm honest. It's been
350 million gross a week.
I've actually heard it's 250 million gross. It's not even 350 million.
It's half, anyway. let's not get into that.
That's the amount we allegedly spend on the EU every day, is it? Is that what they say?
Every week.
Every week, sorry.
So, the reason I bring up Katie Hopkins is one, because we like talking about media trolls every now and again on this podcast, and two, because I think I actually agree with her.
Okay, so explain your position.
So I listened to a Guardian podcast that was specifically an obituary to Jo Cox, and the amount of times that they brought back her views in line with Guardian editorial stances was, like, I almost tweeted Jimmy.
I nearly tweeted.
Then I couldn't find the right person to tag in to complain to, so I didn't in the end.
There's been quite a lot of writing, not necessarily just from The Guardian, but there was an article by Laurie Penny in The New Statesman that I, judging by what you've just said about that podcast, did a similar thing of linking the referendum campaign and what happened. So it does, but you could equally argue that in some of the right-wing coverage, they've sought to explicitly do the opposite of that.
Can you find me an example of that? Because I actually struggled to. Because I was quite ready to, you know, like, I'm a lefty liberal, I'd quite like to believe that the left is not being particularly horrible in this particular sense, but...
Well, I suppose to refer back to the previous topic, I guess, the... it's that whole thing of, like, we're in the, with the shooter in Florida, is it his Muslim leanings that caused him to do what he did? Is it the his internalised homophobia that caused him to do what he did? Is it the gun thing? And it's even just, like, arguing against a narrative that somebody's tried to put on a particular deaf, if you like, is playing the game somewhat. I mean, even if you're not proposing a counter-narrative as such... the attempts to minimise, like, any kind of link, or, like, say, this has nothing to do with the political debates we've been having.
Do you think that there is any justification in... Or where do you think the line is when it comes to talking about Jo Cox as a campaigner and as an activist and as an MP, and talking about her stances on things like the EU referendum that are very real at the moment? Where do you think the line is where you start to manipulate for the Remain's own good?
So this is, I guess, a personal view about news, but I think all news is basically propaganda. It's all...
So I like to describe it as events seen through people's eyes.
Well, propaganda. There's this phrase in American politics, sorry, American journalism, which is, we write the news from nobody's point of view, which is ridiculous. The whole point about...
Do you know what Fox's tagline is?
What is it?
Fair and balanced.
Fair and balanced.
Yeah.
I mean, every newspaper outlet purports to be impartial, unbiased. Actually, to be fair, some of them don't, but a lot of them do. A lot of the more highbrow ones do. And this is just bollocks. The whole point about gathering news and deciding what's fit to print, in the New York Times phrase, is that you have to decide what's of interest to your readers. And as soon as you've done that, you're immediately writing it from somebody's point of view. So it's not really possible to actually, like, the whole fact that we've, like, anyone's decided this is worth printing, and then they decide, oh, what facts would be relevant to put into this obituary of Jo Cox, say? Oh, the fact that she was a campaigner for Syrian refugees, given all the debates we've been having, given the EU referendum, it's obviously relevant to pull that in. And immediately you're starting to frame stuff, and, like, that's what journalism is. You know, journalism is never the impartial reporting of facts. Even if you're, like, writing for, like, business journalism, you're assembling facts because you think they'd be useful for somebody to make a business decision off the back of, which is the same idea. It's just not politicised quite as much.
Do you think if this affects the do you think this will affect the campaign in one way or the other? Because we just had new polls come out today, I think from Ipsos Mori, that showed Remain get a bit of a bolster.
Yeah, the I think this is true. You should never place too much weight on a single poll. You should always try and... I mean, you could even argue that polls far out into the distance before the referendum are not... or before an election are not that relevant, because often non-political people don't give a shit up until the last week or the last couple of weeks. But generally, you want to go by a poll of polls, like an aggregation of polls, which tend to give a slightly more accurate picture. They're by no means perfect, but... I also think that a lot of events that people say are very important in swinging people's views from one side to the other are often not that relevant. I think that's just if you're writing daily news, you tend to place a heightened importance on what's happened
that day.
Does it really matter? I mean, we had a couple of a couple of like Labour Party members, one of who worked with Chuck Romania, Gabriel Huntley, and he spoke explicitly about that. It's like,
you got everybody's name pronounced wrong there.
Gabriel Huntley?
Yeah.
Sorry.
And Chukwuemeka.
Chukwuemeka.
Yeah.
Anyway, the people whose names I've pronounced, mispronounced. Gabriel said explicitly, day-to-day events are not so important. It's more like longer-term things. Mm-hmm. But it's a newsman's mindset, I suppose, just to think that this is really important and significant. Whether, like, the thing is, we'll never be able to know, because it could have been... had, you know, the events in last week not happened, it could have been that they might have been a swing back to Remain anyway, and we can't test that because we don't have alternative universes where...
We do have alternative universes, we just can't get to them.
Well, you know, it's the same thing from a practical point of view, isn't it? So...
Do you think that... Have you seen any justification of the criticism from Katie Hopkins of the Remain camp using Joe Cox's death to further their agenda?
I mean, do I agree that they've done that? Mm. Yeah, they have done that. Mm-hmm. It's just, but they've done it for, like... No one should be under any illusion here that, like, the press is trying to... Nobody writes journalism just because they're really interested in facts in and of themselves, you know? The whole thing of, like, we're all truth seekers here, it's bollocks, basically.
Do you think that this might be why, Jimmy, that your profession is the second most despised in the country?
Behind politicians?
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, it's the nature of the game, isn't it? You know, we could talk... I'm sure we'll talk about press regulation at some point in the future, but that is my view on things. So, should we wrap this up?
Yeah, shall we? We shall wrap this up.
This week, we are finally going to have the referendum, the thing that everybody has been waiting for so long, on the 23rd of June. We are going to vote as to whether we stay or leave the European Union. Jazza, how are you feeling about this?
Yeah, great. Really good. I think that us having a say over democracy is a great idea, because the UK electorate is so really informed about everything.
I'm kind of interested in this argument, because, like, I don't know, a couple of weeks back, David Mitchell wrote for The Observer, David Mitchell, the British comedian, that we're not well informed enough to make a decision as to whether we should remain within the EU. Is that a view that you hold?
People think that they are, but they are wrong. Like, for example, the fact that the Leave campaign have been using the gross figure deliberately misleadingly about how much money we send to the EU. That purely the language that they use around it is so deliberately ambiguous that makes it sound like we just go, here, you have some money, and then we never see it again. And to be honest, the opposite side are equally bad, but because that's the only thing that they can do to counteract it, I should say
the Remain side, I don't think is equally bad, although they are bad.
Like, yeah, they're still bad. But yeah. So, for example, there was a video going around Facebook the other day that had people give this roaming reporter a pound, and then he gave them back a tenner. And that is also not how the UK and EU relationship works. Like, it's just simplifying stuff down to incorrect facts.
Okay.
Also, the fact that Turkey joining the EU has become a big thing. Turkey has met one of the 35 conditions for it to join the European Union in the past 30 years. The chances of that going through relatively small in the next few years, to be completely honest. Stuff like how democratic the EU is, and like what the EU Commission and the EU Parliament do. It's the issue that we have here. Me, as in case you can't notice, I'm for Remain.
Are you, Jess?
I am. Yeah, yeah.
So you've kept that quiet.
I have, haven't I? We're not allowed to talk about the EU in the office anymore because I just go off on one. And I've essentially bullied everybody else to voting Remain. And they're like,
You're an awful person.
I know, I'm
am I allowed to respond to this general charge of ignorance and stupidity among the British electorate?
Yeah.
So, yeah, like...
I'm, good, you agree. So,
I agree that, like, voters are generally not well informed enough about specific policy, certainly, and how specific governance models work and all of that junk to make a decision. However, I think the one valid use for a referendum is on vote is when people are voting on where and which structures they'll be governed under. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing about the Scottish referendum as to whether they should be governed just from, say, Edinburgh, but also via Brussels as well because of the European Union membership, or whether they should be governed from Edinburgh, from Westminster, and from Brussels, again, because of the EU membership. That's the one valid use of a referendum for me. And the reason is that you can't ask the governors to vote on how people will be governed, if you see what I mean. I mean, there's just an obvious conflict of interest there. Whereas, I mean, it's the same thing when you have an election, just a general election. That is effectively a referendum on who's in charge.
Sure, right. Great. So I agree. I have always said that we should have a referendum on the EU, quite frankly, because I'm sick of going on about it all the time, to be completely honest.
How's that worked out for you?
Terribly. Because now Leave are ahead. Or, like there seems in last week that there was a big kind of tilt towards
Leave. So last week, like, I think on average, Leave were a couple of points ahead. Like, but if you look at the book...
So a poll came out for the Independent on Friday night.
Right.
That showed Leave 10 points ahead.
Ten points?
Yeah, and me and my mate, who are having a beer together, just kind of sat there in silence and were really depressed for the rest of the night. I just want it to be over so I can start having fun with my life again.
But do you think it will... This won't end it, will it? I mean, if we vote to
Leave... No, it won't end it, but at least... Shut them up for, like, a decade, maybe.
Do you think... If it's close... Like, I mean, we've seen with the Scottish referendum, that was, like, 45-55 to remain within the UK.
Yeah, so this is the thing that kind of frustrates me, is the idea that if it's close... both sides have said this is a definitive, once-in-a-lifetime decision. Great. The thing is... If we have, like, a 51-49 in favour of remaining, this train doesn't stop. It keeps on going.
Yeah, yeah.
And we probably get another referendum in the next, like, 5 years.
I don't know if we'll get a referendum.
Maybe not. But this continues. This whole anti-EU stuff continues.
It certainly continues, yeah.
If we get a 51-49 vote in favour of leaving, we're out.
Mm.
And it, like, can't go back in. Like,
we could potentially reapply in a decade or two.
Yeah, but we'd have to have the EU. We'd have to apply by a load of different directives that we wouldn't have had a say in. Like, the idea that we could possibly go back in, I think, is absolutely fucking nutty.
No, we could go back in.
No, I'm quite pro EU. I don't think I'd like the conditions that the UK would have to adhere to.
They would be
10, 15
years.
They
would be worse. I'm not disputing that, but we could go back in.
We've got such a good deal. Why are people throwing it away?
Immigrants. See, I'm potentially going to vote Leave, which is going to upset you.
No.
I'm going to explain my reasoning why.
No.
I have to. This is not proving a productive conversation.
No!
Okay, have you heard Tony Benn's arguments for leaving the EU? Are you vaguely familiar with them?
Yeah, like, left shit, no neoliberalism,
No, the best argument that Tony Benn ever came up with for leaving the EU is that it's a point about democratic accountability. Like, how do you get rid of these people who are governing you? And with the EU, it's not obvious how one would do that. It's that whole thing of, like, whoever you vote for, you get the same government. I mean, that is literally true in the case of the EU, I think.
I don't understand that argument. May I tell you why?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I am also not able to get rid of the person who's governing me.
Oh, because you're in a safe suit.
Yeah.
Mm.
I find that argument ridiculous. Because I have as much... the people in this constituency that I live in, as a mass, have decided that... They're going to be
sure,
Labour.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, come what may. But no matter how I vote, my voice doesn't get heard.
My voice gets heard more
in the EU Parliament than it does here.
Why do you say that?
Because we have a proportionate representation system.
But the role of an MEP in relation to how the EU is governed is quite different from the role of an MP in relation to how Britain's governed.
Yes, correct.
They're not really equivalent roles.
They aren't equivalent roles, which is also part of the problem, because it's quite a difficult thing to equate.
Hmm.
Because the Commission and the Parliament in the European Union do not work in the same way in the slightest in the ways that our two chambers, the Lords and the Commons, work in Westminster. The Commission basically proposes the overall view of how the EU goes forward and what needs to be done, and then individual bits of those kinds of overall views get voted on by the Parliament.
Yeah.
And so they work in, like, in tandem in that way, but there isn't really an equivalent way of them, of the, like, two legislative bodies working in that way in the UK. Which is one of the reasons that it doesn't really have a mojo.
The European Parliament is really a vetting committee.
Mm-hmm.
It's better to understand it in those terms. It's not really a legislative chamber as such.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree.
Whereas the Commission's like a combination of a civil service and an executive government, so similar to a cabinet in British terms.
Yeah.
But it's quite... I mean, from a personal level, I don't like that distribution of powers. The reason why... the European Union is structured that way is because it's kind of like started off as an international treaty with mm-hmm. various members, and it's kind of morphed into a kind of inchoate government.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's in a bad state at the moment, and that leads back to the Tony Benn argument about democratic accountability and not mm-hmm. being able to vote the people in power out of power. I grant you, like, there's problems with the British system, but broadly speaking, in Britain, if the country as a whole does not like the government, they can vote in a new one.
Mm-hmm.
If the European people as a unit, which isn't really a thing, politically speaking, there is, in a sense, no such thing as a European society, in the sense there's a British society, French society, and so on. If they don't like the way the European government is going, there's no obvious controls that, like, we particularly have over what goes on there, because the responsibility for government...
But the Parliament is able to vote down stuff it's proposed by the Commission.
It is, but...
And so those...
It generally doesn't, which is surprising, given how a lot of people voted for a Eurosceptic MEP, more than there are actual Eurosceptics
across Europe.
Yeah, but
what's the reason for that? Because Eurosceptic MPs don't turn up to Parliament.
Mm.
UKIP, at least, just don't do their job.
Yeah.
And they would have been able to do a load of things in the past however many years to protect British fishing quotas, to make the EU more democratic. They actually turned up to fucking work. And they have this vested interest in making sure that the EU doesn't work for British people and doesn't do the things that it's meant to do and isn't democratic. Half of the MPs that we send,
I suppose, that
don't want the EU to work.
That is true, but I think there's also reluctance within the Commission itself for like substantial reform. I think that there's an element throughout the European Union's history of an elite talking down to the European people, and I know that's like that is a thing seized on by Brexiteers and Leave campaigners. There's an element of truth in that. That is an instinct within European politics.
But this is kind of the problem that I have specifically with... I've forgotten the thing that you just said.
There's an instinct of elitism in the EU politics. In the way the EU has made up and is formed, there's an instinct of an elite talking down to the European people. I mean, the obvious examples are the various referendums that people have had
that have been ignored
on European treaties. That have been ignored,
So I don't doubt that there's a problem with that.
Yeah.
I don't think that the EU is perfect. I think that the EU is quite patronising to a lot of its people in like, and also undemocratic in the way that it's ignored referenda.
Yeah.
But that has been a state by like the France decided to ignore the no vote to the Lisbon Treaty that they had, and the similar thing with Ireland. Ireland decided to do that. They could have just. They could have done something about it. I feel that was the government, the local government's unwillingness to listen to its own people. I don't think that was necessarily an EU thing, but what I think that the main problem with the EU is that it doesn't really have a mojo or like it doesn't really have a unit. Feel? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think that matches the thing I said about there's no sense of European society. Like, if you look at America, in elections, Americans vote as Americans, whereas there's not really a sense that Europeans vote as Europeans, mm-hmm. even in European elections. They use it as a way of getting back at the whatever national government it is that they're involved in.
Yeah, which is part of the issue, because we could actually make the EU work for us a lot better, and the way that our members of European Parliament work doesn't allow for that.
See, this is like the weirdness of my particular view on the EU is that I'm not necessarily hostile to like a proper European federation, but I just don't see it. There seems to you'd need to have so many stars aligning to actually get the reform that was necessary. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem workable to me.
So this is another issue that I have with that particular kind of point of view, because we are inevitably going to be tangled up with the EU forever. Mm. Like in some way, shape, or form, our economies are linked.
I mean, people have been talking about the EU collapsing in the wake of Brexit because other countries vote to leave, that's possible.
That's going to be a terrible, terrible thing. Like there will be a huge and deep and like consequential recession if that happens. Why do we want that, first of all? But also, we are going to be intertwined with its future, whether we like it or not, and whether we're a member or not.
Yeah, but the only way our military policy is intertwined with America's. I don't see that as justification for us becoming a 51st state of the US.
Yeah, but I feel like you're comparing apples and oranges there.
Just because we have a relationship with a neighbouring country does not mean we have to belong to that country. I mean, you can make the same argument about Ireland. Obviously, Ireland, or even Scotland, is going to be wrapped up in British or English affairs because of the proximity. Uh-huh. That doesn't mean that they have to sit under the same government.
So here's my issues with you voting Leave.
Okay.
Despite the fact that you've betrayed me greatly.
I haven't said I'm definitely voting Leave. I'm just leaning that way.
If we leave, Scotland probably becomes an independent country.
I disagree. I disagree with that.
Let me put you facts. Scotland probably becomes an independent country.
I don't think it does.
If we leave, we still have to adhere to all of the product regulations that happen within the EU.
No, we don't.
Don't. Why would anybody make something for a market of 70 million people when they could make it for a market of 500 million? Why would any business?
Well, because some businesses
think that that's a good idea.
Some businesses do not have significant trade with the EU.
No, but if you want there to be any kind of expansion in your business, then you need to export. And
it depends what sort of business you're in.
What else happens if we leave the EU? There is going to be a bump in the road, most optimistic.
A technical recession, as Mark Carney put it.
Yeah, there will be like an economic bump in the road if we leave the EU. We are not taken as seriously on the international stage as a nation by the likes of China, by the likes of the US.
I don't think we're taken seriously by China anyway.
I think that at the moment we have a certain amount of clout. We're going to be like Iceland if we leave.
We're not going to be like Iceland if we leave. Iceland is a country of 300,000 people,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
With as far as I'm aware, no military whatsoever, or not, you know, no significant military, no historical ties to, like, every other continent. That is comparing apples and oranges, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah. Jimmy, I just feel really betrayed.
I didn't say it. Like, I gave indications that I was sceptical.
I thought you'd come round. I thought you'd come round. I'm just really sad about the whole thing.
From your point of view, is it actually going to be that bad?
I think it is the most stupid thing that we could possibly do.
The most stupid thing.
Also, we end up with probably the most right-wing government ever in modern British history. With somebody like... people like Boris Johnson, Priti Patel and Michael Gove at the helm. Priti Patel wants to bring back the death penalty. Michael Gove wants to privatise the NHS unapologetically. And Boris Johnson is a joke.
That might happen anyway. Have you seen the opposition?
Yeah, but it means... I would rather the centre-right government that we have at the moment than the nut jobs that are running the Leave campaign.
Yeah, but the thing is that, assuming that we remain, say, either the Tories, like, the Osborne-Cameron axis, like, decides to take revenge on the Leavers and pretty much ends their political careers. I don't actually think that's possible. Like, but it's, like, say that that's an option. The other option is that they somewhat heal the rift, and then Cameron decides to step down in a couple of years. Osborne goes up against Johnson, probably loses anyway. Like, Johnson probably still becomes Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
I think Boris Johnson, I mean, initially when we were sort of discussing whether Boris Johnson would campaign to leave or remain, I said if he campaigned to leave and lost, it would mean the end of his political career. I think that's wrong, actually. I think even if Leave loses, I think Boris Johnson is still on course to be Prime Minister.
Great, excellent. We have that to look forward to. Anything else you want to say about Brexit?
I think it'll be okay, either way. I don't think, like, I think people are overreacting a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Cool. See you next week. if you liked this, I'm so annoyed. Please leave us a review, tweet us at Right Dishonor, and send Jimmy death threats. Okay.
Wow.
Bye. Hello, my name is Jazza, and the story is really depressing. And Jimmy?
Hello, my name's Jimmy, and I'm trying to read some stuff on my phone, but Jazza's interrupting me with his...
Us to have shit sound levels again?
No, I don't.
Yeah, so making sure that this is professional as fucking possible, all right. Thanks.